broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Welcome, everyone, to the Refresher Wealth Podcast with Matt Sorensen and Mark Kohler. Mark Kohler, though, is not with us today. He is out on assignment in, I think, Arkansas, if you can believe it. He's quite the big draw in Arkansas. He goes out there, and he's kind of a big deal when he goes to Arkansas. So, but I am joined today by Jaron Burgesson. He's an attorney in our office in Utah. He's been with us for years. And, you know, Jaron's got, I think, a journalism degree. It's a broadcast journalism, just regular journalism.
Broadcast journalism.
Yep. Broadcast journalism. And I think you'll see it was money well spent today. So so thanks for being here, Jaron, and pitching in to help me. I appreciate it.
No problem. Mark in Arkansas, I think only Bill and Hillary Clinton outdraw Mark Kohler. In
That's true. Maybe the Arkansas Razorbacks, maybe they got a bigger crowd. That's maybe third place. Mark Kohler's in third. Yeah. So, well, thanks for being with us today. If you're new to the show, the, Refresh Wealth Podcast is all about living the American dream, helping you protect your assets, save taxes, build wealth. We try and keep it light and entertaining, but we want to educate you. We don't want to just, you know, try and make jokes and fail all day long. We try to provide some education. And today we'll be in that vein, of course, and we'll be talking about raising money from friends and family. Many of you who are entrepreneurs out in the trenches, business owners looking to start a business or fund a real estate deal, or maybe you're already in business and you want to grow. We want to talk about some of the strategies and legal issues that are upon you when you try to raise money from friends and family. And Jaron is the resident expert in the office, I should say, on this topic. So I'll be quizzing him. He's got a blog article up recently on the topic too, which will be a good resource. And so we'll begin to that in the second half of the hour of the show today. But it's a really important topic, and I think one you can share with others who are out there looking to start the business, because it takes money. I mean, we brought out Hillary Clinton. It takes a village, but starting a business takes money. So we'll obviously dive into how to get that legally. All right. Well, before we get into the show, we always like to give a tax and legal tip, something a little bit off topic. And Jaron, I don't know, do you want me to go first? Are you ready to go? You tell me. You're the guest host today. So
all right. I'm gonna let you go first, but I'm ready.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm ready. So, all right. Well, I'm going to give the tax tip today.
A tax tip you can actually understand and won't put you to sleep.
A tax tip that could save you thousands.
All right. Well, today's tax tip, and I have a blog article up on this recently. It was in the newsletter, and it's about what do you need to know if you and your money move offshore? And so there's a couple of quick tax items to think about when you move your money offshore. And also there's some tax items to think about when you move personally offshore. And there's more detail on this and the citations and the IRS forms and all that in my blog article. I'm going to give you the rough notes here. The first thing, let's say you want to just move some money offshore. You know, you want that sexy Swiss bank account or the secret account in Panama, whatever. If you're into that, and I get it, I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of reasons to do that. Besides it sounding cool, I'm not meaning to joke too much here, but obviously there's a lot of reasons to do that. So if you have a foreign bank account, if you are a U.S. citizen and you have a foreign bank account with $10,000 or more in it, you need to report to the IRS and you have to disclose the bank account. This is used, this is done on what's called an FBAR form, Foreign Bank Account Reporting. And it's really just a disclosure reporting requirement that you have to tell the IRS, hey, I got $100,000 in this bank in the Cayman Islands, or I got, you know, X amount of dollars in the Swiss bank account. And it's not that you're paying tax on that necessarily. I mean, if you're making money on that account from investments or interest, you will pay tax. But the issue is really on this FBAR form is just a disclosure requirement. Now, the next item, though, that you have to do is you also have to report foreign assets on your tax return, or when you file your tax return, of over $50,000. So let's say I had a Swiss bank account with $100,000. Well, I've got to report it because it's a bank account over 10. I got to do this FBAR form to the IRS and just say I've got it. And secondly, though, if it's because it's an asset over 50, I also have to do a foreign asset disclosure to the IRS saying I've got an asset over 50. And this, you'd have the same requirement if you own foreign real estate or foreign investments. You would need to disclose those assets to the IRS. Again, it's not a, there's not a tax due on it necessarily unless you have income from it, but this is just a disclosure requirement. Now, the other note I wanted to point out is what if I want to move myself outside the U.S.? And there's a big misconception here, and this is the one primary point I want to make. There's a lot of other points to be made on this if from a tax standpoint is if I leave the U.S. But one of the big misconceptions I hear is clients will say, hey, I'm going to move. I want to move to the Bahamas. I mean, why not? You know, it sounds there's beaches there they don't have any income tax there. So I'm just going to move, you know, myself and maybe my money to some foreign country that has no income tax. And then I don't have to pay tax on all this money I might have, you know, from other investments I have or businesses I may own. Wrong. Sorry, that's not going to happen. If you are still a U.S. citizen, it does not matter where you are physically residing. If you're in the U.S., if you're outside the U.S., if you're on Mars, it doesn't matter where you are. If you're a U.S. citizen, you're paying tax on the income you make worldwide. Whether you make it in the U.S. or you make it in a foreign country, the U.S. doesn't care. You're paying tax on it. So now if you're paying tax in the country you're in, let's say you're in, you know, Mexico or Canada, and you're paying income tax to those countries, you also pay in the U.S., but you get a credit for what you paid in that foreign country. But I just want to dispel the notion that moving to a foreign country that has no income tax will get you out of having to pay income tax to the U.S. It ain't that easy. Sorry. The only way you can get outside of that is to essentially renounce your citizenship. It's a process you have to go through. There's been some famous people that have done that over the years, like Eduardo Saverin, one of the Facebook founders. There's been some other high-profile people who have gone through that process and become a citizen of another country and taken their hundreds of millions, billions of dollars elsewhere. And but you give up the luxury of being a U.S. citizen. I shouldn't say the luxury. I mean, it is a luxury, let's be honest, in many ways. But you give up that privilege or all the other rights of citizenship when you do that. So that's the only way you get out from paying U.S. tax. So just keep in mind, if you move your money offshore, you've got some disclosure requirements to the IRS. And if you move yourself offshore outside the U.S., don't think you're getting out of paying U.S. taxes anymore just because your butt isn't in the great old USA anymore. Sorry, you're still going to have to pay tax in the U.S. All right. Now, there's more detail, of course, on my blog at sdrahandbook.com. You can also get it through the law firm blog, kkoslawyers.com. On that topic, I have the forms and the IRS rules and instructions too, which you can access there on each of those points. So, all right, Jerem, you got a legal tip for us?
I do.
What do you got? All right. Okay. Fire away, my friend.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit on the legal tip about when a holding company, LLC, makes sense. Lots of people feel like they need one all the time. It's not always necessary. So I wanted to talk about when it is necessary or not even necessary, but maybe a good idea.
A legal tip that you can actually use.
A legal tip where you don't feel like you have to take a shower after.
So, you know, like I said, there are lots of kind of practitioners out there that say, well, you always have to have this holding company, and then it's going to own an LLC that's going to own your rental property. That's not always something that you have to have. The LLC, if you've got an LLC that owns your rental property, that LLC is going to provide you with limited liability protection. If somebody gets hurt on that property, they want to sue the property owner. That property owner is the LLC, not you. And if you're operating the LLC correctly, that LLC, whether it's in Wyoming or, you know, Louisiana or whatever state, and we typically want it to be in the state where the property is located, that LLC is going to provide some limited liability protection to you for the debts, obligations, and liabilities associated with the property. Where a holding company can come in is and provide some additional protection is in a situation where maybe that rental property's got a lot of equity in it. Maybe it's paid off and it's worth a couple $100,000. What happens if I go out and get in a car accident? That's my fault. And somebody dies and they sue me and they get a judgment against me that exceeds my auto policy limits. Now they're going to start coming after my assets. If I own an LLC that owns a rental, it's possible in some states they're going to be able to force me to dissolve that entity. They're going to be able to force me to liquidate that asset, that property, that rental property. They're going to force me to sell it to help pay off that debt that I have personally. If instead I've got a holding company, usually a Wyoming LLC in the mix, now what I own is 100% of a Wyoming LLC, and that Wyoming LLC owns my LLC in Louisiana that owns my rental property in Baton Rouge. Now, when I get in that car accident that's my fault and they're coming after my assets, what I own is 100% of that Wyoming LLC. And Wyoming law says the only remedy that that person has against my LLC is something called a charging order. And the charging order says that LLC ever makes a distribution of capital, of profits to me, they get to step into my shoes. However, they can't force that LLC to make a distribution. They can't force that LLC to sell a property. They are kind of just sitting out there on the outside, and they can't do much of anything to force me to pay them off. So that charging order protection of that holding company has stepped in and put me potentially in a much better situation. So when that holding company can make sense is when I, that charging order protection holding company entity can make sense is if my LLC's got an asset that's got a lot of equity in it and I'm worried about getting sued personally, then yeah, I love that structure. It makes a lot of sense. But if my rental property isn't worth that much or is mortgaged to the hilt, then it might be overkill. So
Yeah, no, I think that's the important takeaway too at the end for many people is it's weird. I think more people have the holding company structure that don't need it than have it and do need it, I think. I run into a lot of people who set it up and it's like, well, you don't really need this. And someone just sold them more than they needed, or they bought some package at some seminar or whatever. I don't know. And they got oversold on it. So, but we love this strategy and we do it when it fits. And I kind of like for a client, I'm kind of looking at someone that's got about $1 million in total assets when I'm looking at this. And, or it could be maybe a few hundred thousand dollars just in equity and rental properties too that are owned by these property holding LLCs. I think what you could look at it. But if you're buying your first rental property and you're getting a mortgage on it, don't even be thinking about this, you know, right. Even your first few, you're getting mortgages on them. You haven't owned them that long. You don't have much equity. Don't waste your time with it. It ain't worth the hassle and the cost.
Yep. Unnecessarily complex and expensive in that case. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can learn more about this. Mark has some of this in his book, The Tax and Legal Playbook. There's some blog articles on it. Sometimes the holding company is referred to as a charging order protection entity or COPE. And Wyoming, as Jeremy mentioned, has some kind of unique perks to that of why we would use them. So, well, thanks for the legal tip, Jeremy. Appreciate that.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's get into the topic today for the show and talk about raising your first, I don't know, sometimes it's called round of financing, but raising your first pile of money, okay? we want to talk about from friends and family. And as you go through the cycle of a business and maybe raising money and getting access to other investors, there's different variations of this, but we want to keep it basic on kind of this first chunk of startup funds that you may be raising for your money or first chunk of funds to maybe grow your small business. So, Jeremy, I like your article on how you talked about kind of the friends and family round of raising money. There's got to be some specific laws about friends and family, right? That if I raise money from them, I get some special treatment. How does that work?
Yeah, unfortunately, and that's a common misconception, really common misconception that's out there, that if I raise money, you know, I let people invest in my business, and they're my friends and family, that I don't have to worry about securities laws or there's some sort of exemption. And there just isn't one.
Jerem read all the securities laws, all the regulations, and he was looking for that. And
yeah, I did.
You would be disappointed to find it does not exist.
It doesn't exist. Now, where this, I think, comes from is there are certain situations in certain states and under other regulations where having a pre-existing substantial relationship with an investor can otherwise, and if they fit into other boxes, now you can take money from them. But there's not a specific friends and family exemption at the state at any state level that I'm aware of, and there certainly isn't one at the federal Securities and Exchange Commission level.
Yeah. And I think one thing I think is really helpful at the outset here to talk about is I think when it comes to the securities laws and when we're talking about raising money from other people, that's this, you know, this area of law you got to be careful about, securities laws. And there's criminal and civil penalties to this stuff. So it's not like you can just get sued. I mean, there's people that go to jail that mess this stuff up.
Right.
Just ask Martha Stewart. I mean, she can tell you. So, but the hard part about the securities laws in this small amount of money, you know, I'd say kind of under a million or less raising, maybe it is just a small group of people, less than 10, let's say, there's just not like a way you just do it where it's like, oh, well, if you just do it this way, you're totally clean and it's fine.
Right.
I almost like to tell clients sometimes it's like this spectrum of raising money where it's like, if you tell me you've done five things, like you've made advertisements, you've solicited, you've given guaranteed returns to people you say you would do, you know one of the 10 people that are putting in money and the others you really don't know, or you have a very loose association with, I'm worried about you over there. You know what I mean? You're on the spectrum of, you've done a couple of things that I'm like, if you lose these people's money, they're going to have a pretty good claim. And if some regulator comes in from the SEC or State Securities Division, you're going to have a lot of problems.
Right.
But then on the other end of the spectrum is, you know, you got three people that put in money. One was your college roommate you've known for 10 or 20 years now. One's your cousin. And, you know, one's your neighbor that's rich that just wants to put some money into the thing. And they're partners in the deal with them. They know what's going on with you. You know, they even have some voting rights and you didn't solicit or market. You're on the spectrum. I'm not worried if the deal goes bad or your business goes bad and you don't lose and you lose their money. Right. And so, unfortunately, I think most people kind of find themselves in the middle of that, Jeremy, don't you think?
Yeah. Right. They're somewhere in the gray area and in between. Right.
So maybe give us some tips on, I know in your article you talked about existing relationship and also them participating in the business.
Right.
I know there's some other kind of tried and true things to do
Right.
Give us some ideas on what people can do to, you know, lawfully raise money and not have to, you know, stress out.
Right. So I guess all the way over on the spectrum where I'm not worried at all is if, you know, people are giving you money and they're not expecting anything in return, they just, hey, I love you. You know, your dad gives you money and it's not a loan. It's not, they're not expecting anything back. That's fine. We don't have to jump through these hoops because you're not selling them something. They're not getting anything in return. They gave you a gift.
Yeah.
Not a big deal. Kind of moving along that spectrum, if you're raising money from a small number of people and you have pre-existing relationships with them and you didn't go out and advertise this offering somewhere, you didn't cold call people. These are people you have a pre-existing relationship with and they're participating in the business. Maybe they bring some level of expertise in what you're doing that you're going to rely on, or you're giving them voting rights where we're going to invest in real estate. And they, if everybody doesn't agree, then we're not going to invest in this piece of real estate. So they have a measure of control over what the company does. Then they're really not investors that you're raising money from. They're partners in your deal. And if they're partners and they're bringing something to the table other than money, and or they have some control over what this business is going to do, then you're still on that part of the spectrum where I'm not worried. So this probably isn't a security that you sold them, because they're not just relying on you and your work and your expertise and your knowledge to turn them a profit. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a big distinction in the securities laws is, you know, the definition of a security, and this is, there's a Supreme Court case on this called Howey, said an investment of money in a common enterprise where profits and losses are derived solely from the efforts of others. Well, if you think about it, in any time someone puts money into my business, I've always got the first two. They've invested their money in a common enterprise, you know, some business. So that's got, you know, I presumably when I put money in there, I've got some interest in it. So it's a common enterprise. But the last one is what makes it not a security in the partnership scenario, where it says where profits and losses are derived solely from the efforts of others. So if they're in this business with me as a partner, even if they put in cash, they're kind of the cash partner, but they also have voting rights and are participating and involved in the business. They don't need to be working in it day to day. They just, you know, need to be maybe coming to quarterly meetings or maybe a monthly meeting or conference calls. And, you know, they know what's going on. They're voting on the big decisions.
Right.
That makes them a partner where they fall outside of this securities definition. And Jeremy, I think that one is one of the most common ways. And I think for people starting off,
it is. It's very, very much common where, hey, this person's the cash partner, this person's the work partner, and we're gonna work together. But I go back to investing in real estate. But when it comes to whether we're gonna buy or sell a property, we both have to participate and sign off on that decision.
Yeah,
that's probably not. It's almost certainly not a security. People will. What I guess a big piece of advice I would give is don't try to get cute with these things though and say, I'm going to beat the system and go, you know what, I'm going to raise money from 50 people or 20 even people. They're each going to put in 50 grand and they're each going to own, you know, some small percentage of this company, but it's going to be less than 50%. And I'm going to make all the decisions because I'm going to own more than 50%. And I'm going to put in the operating agreement that all decisions are made by majority rule. And guess what? I own 51%. So I run everything.
Yeah.
That is, you are getting in the dark gray area. And if that deal goes bad or goes really good and, you know, securities regulators figure it, see it, that, you know, and you do it again and again and again, that's where you can get into trouble.
Yeah. Very true. I think, great point. So if we take a step back and we say, all right, I'm listening to you guys. I want to get some money from some friends and family. I've got a handful of people, you know, 3, 4, 5 people, whatever. They're each putting in some money. Here's just a couple things, just tips. Make sure they're somewhat involved in the business. They don't need to be like running working there day to day like you are. Okay.
Right.
But make sure that they have some involvement, and big decision items, you're checking with them. Like, for example, can I get a big credit line? Can I get a huge amount of debt? Can I change the nature of the business? You know, and I was going to start a website selling, you know, clothing. Now I'm going to sell cars at on a, you know, on the corner. You're going to change the nature of the business, that needs to be voted on, obviously. Maybe your own compensation as the person running it. If you're taking a salary, you're taking some compensation, maybe that would need to be approved by them too. And there could be other things you include in there, but the key is they do have a say on big items. You don't need them approving whether you're going to, you know, hire an employee necessarily, or,
or what color the cabinets are going to be in the houses that you're flipping or something.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so, so have them involved and have documentation that they're involved. This is one thing on where we want to do an LLC. You want to have it clear on these issues. And I think for many business owners, particularly those that are raising money, that usually means they need money to do this. Don't be cheap about it. Okay. These documents are for your benefit and protection as much as they are the investors, or your new partners, I should say, cash partners. Because they outline and save your butt in the event money goes missing, or you know, the business just doesn't work, I should say, and someone's, you know, a lawyer or a regulator sniffing around to see, did this person do something wrong? You want to have the documents say, no, I didn't. We documented this properly. We did it right. They were involved. They had some voting rights. And so that's those documents are for your protection as much as they are the investor. So don't skip over it.
Right. Well, and this probably goes without saying a little bit, but it doesn't matter how good your documents are if you're just out and out lying to people, you know, telling them, I'm going to do this with your money, and then you go and do something else. Or, I'm going to do this with your money, and then you go use it to pay off people that invested previously. That's called a Ponzi scheme. You know, those sorts of things. It doesn't matter how good your documents are. If you're committing fraud in some way, not that anybody listening to this podcast commits fraud. I know they don't, but you know, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Some people go, well, I have all these documents. Well, you still are lying to people. That's still securities fraud. So there's no way to paper over that.
Yeah. And let's stay for today. I mean, there are other ways you can raise money. And I know Jerem's article goes into this on Reg D offerings, Rule 506. And these are ways you can basically get a lot of people involved in, where you get, you know, 10, 20, 30, 100 people, right, invested, and you don't have to give them voting rights.
That's the key. Yeah. Where they really want to be a silent partner. They don't want to participate. They don't, and you don't want them to. That's where those come in.
Yeah. And I think those, you know, we'll do later shows on that. And Mark and I have talked about that a little bit. And that's something that Jerem actually does. So if you're like, guys, I need to raise big money for this thing I'm doing, this new business, or it's like, I don't want to give people voting rights. I really don't want them involved in my business, or it's not people I really have a close connection with.
Yeah.
Okay. You need to graduate past this. You're going to do maybe a Reg D offering. Yep. Jerem's article has some details on that, and Jerem sets those up. We always seem to have one or two going at a time. Right. And that's going to cost you money though, Jerem, right? I mean, to set that up and go past this partnership, which I want to come back to, by the way, I want to hone in on this small friends and family situation though, but what's it going to cost to pull that off?
Yeah. I mean, if we're doing a Regulation D offering, which is going to have a private placement, you know, memorandum, there's all kinds of disclosures that need to go in there. You need to be talking to people about the big conflicts of interest that might be out there, risk factors. You know, the private placement memorandum is not a sales document. It's about, here are the ways we could lose your money.
It's like the opposite of a sales pitch.
The CYA document. It's the document that says, I told you that this could go south, and I was specific about how. And yeah, I told you I was going to do business with this other entity that I own. I disclosed that potential conflict of interest to you. That, you know, that sort of thing. That there's a lot going on there. There's filings at the federal level and state level. You know, we do that work. It's one of the more expensive things we do. It's probably typically $15,000 to $20,000 to $25,000 in attorney's fees to do that kind of work. But that's usually, I'm going to be raising millions, multiple millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So in the that context, it's not a ton of money. But it is. It's more expensive than setting up a partnership LLC, which you might get out for $1,500, mm-hmm. $2,000, something like
yeah.
that.
Well, let's come back to just the friends and family, because I just want to stick for that for today's show. And let's we know there's this other option out here if I need to graduate past that. But what are some other ways that I can kind of, like I said, sleep better at night, so to speak, of just raising money from people I know, the friends and family deal? What if I got people that are like, you know what, can I just loan you the money and you pay it back to me? I don't need to be in your business. Frankly, I don't even know if you're going to be successful or not. I'd rather you just owe me the money. What options do I have there? Can I maybe get a loan from people? Or
yeah, you can take a loan from people, but just because it's a loan in and of itself doesn't mean it's not a security, and doesn't mean you don't still have to jump through all of these hoops necessarily. Now, if the loan is secured typically by real estate, by a deed of trust or a mortgage, we like it to be in first position, then that is typically not going to be considered a security.
Let me jump in on that, if I could just make a couple notes on that. So now that could be, obviously, let's say I'm a real estate investor flipping a house and I want you to loan money on my real estate deal to buy it or rehab it or both. And obviously we just secure it against that property itself, right? I mean, the one I'm buying, that seems the easiest, makes the most sense. And we want it in first, like you said. And I have looked at states, I'll note this, this is even just in the last few months, that some states will say as long as it's fully secured, it doesn't matter if it's first, second, or third even. I was quite surprised in doing some research on this, actually, that it doesn't always have to be first. Some states do specify it needs to be first. What if I want, like, my operating business, you know, I'm providing a service or I'm funding a new product that I'm doing, could I secure it against my house or other property, real estate I own, or other assets, maybe the note?
As long as the security is adequate, and that it gets really technical, but yeah, if your house has enough, you know, if it's already mortgaged to the hilt and you give somebody a second position, and there's no equity left, probably not. But if there is enough value in what you're, you know, inventory of a business, if it does have inventory, and it's got enough that it would fully secure that loan, or your house or that sort of thing, that can be okay.
Yeah. And I think, let me make it even more narrow, because I think sometimes, just so you guys know, and you can see, sometimes I have reluctance, Jeremy will have reluctance, and an answer is,
yeah,
there's 50 different ways this gets treated. Okay, there's 50 states that have issue on this. Generally, on the kind of, you know, small loan scenario, as long as I'm not out soliciting loans every week for my business, you know, it's just kind of, you know, I'm really starting up and I'm funding that at startup. The SEC could care less, but your state regulator, your state division of securities might care. Yeah. And so that's what we want to make sure we're complying with. And there's 50 different state regulators. They each have different regulations on whether they exempt a loan or not. Is it real property? Is it equipment that counts? Does it have to be in first position? Does it just have to be adequately secured? So there's just some, you got to kind of know the nuance in your state when you're doing that. But I think that's another good option though, Jeremy. I think that's common is just the loan. I guess we could say on a basic level, right, the secured loan in general. You might have different requirements on the level of security or whether it's real property or not, but just the secured loan would be kind of the more comfortable, sleep better at night type way to raise money.
Right. And I'm taking a loan from one person or maybe a handful of people.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm getting $50,000 loans from 50 different people.
Yeah. See, and this is why we say, this is why I try to start at the beginning. There's a spectrum to this, okay, where you start moving the dial and you kind of start crossing the line on the spectrum, so to speak. So a handful of loans, I'm not as stressed out. But if you're like, well, I did it 20 times. You said I could do it the first time. Well, the first time was okay, but the 20th, you got a problem. What about, let's maybe talk about some of these intrastate offerings that you talked about. You know, I'm just kind of dealing with people I know and my family close by or neighbors or, you know, whatever within my state, what's kind of these intrastate offerings?
Yeah. So the intrastate offering is if everybody, if all of your investors are from one state and you are doing business, that's the state you do business in. And that's the state you typically you're set up in. Now the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission at the federal level, takes a step back and says, look, if everybody's in one state, then we're going to be kind of hands off. You have to comply with the laws of that state. You don't have to file anything here. It's not across state lines. It's not interstate commerce. You're doing business just in that one state. Jump through their hoops. We don't have hoops. You know, as long as you're fitting through the hoops of you're not doing this in multiple states, yeah. then go jump through that state's hoops. I actually am in the process of doing helping somebody with one of these in California. Mm-hmm. And California obviously is a big state, is a state where this happens a lot. Mm-hmm. Has a pretty decent procedure for you to go through, and believe it or not, fairly reasonable laws for you to comply with to make this work.
Yeah, there's one thing California loves: it's startups.
Yep.
So that is one thing where their laws have actually been somewhat favorable. If you're a regular small business owner out there, though, they hate you. Pay us franchise taxes. You know, we're going to tax the heck out of you. But
right,
they've at least kind of made it easier for startups because, man, they've been the golden child of successful startups. And they've heard from those people that have started those businesses. Let's be honest. They've heard from those top people that have started those businesses and the struggles they had in just complying with the laws. And, you know, this is interesting, Jerem. I listened to a podcast called How I Built This. And it's an NPR podcast, and it's mm-hmm. a bunch of people who have started businesses from, like, Facebook and Instagram. You've got the people that did the Spanx founder. LinkedIn. You got pretty much a lot of the big companies that have been started in the last decade seriously have been on this show. And he actually does a really good job of actually asking them how they got their money to start their business from the very beginning. Yeah. And I'm not kidding. I would say half of those violated securities rules in raising their money. It's surprising, you know?
Yeah.
And they were scrapping together money from people. Some of them got, you know, venture capital and private equity money later, but all of them had to kind of do this friends and family thing first to get it off the ground. And it was getting money from dad or the uncle or the boyfriend. You know, it was very interesting to see how they did this, and they gave them a little piece of the ownership, or it was a loan. And it was so funny for me to hear this and listen to that show and realize that some of these huge companies, many of us use on a daily basis, how they were funded at the very beginning. Everybody has to go through this, really, friends and family, almost everybody, I should say. Goes through this friends and family way of raising the money. So, let's talk about things. Maybe you have a success story. Maybe you can think about that, or just think of here's a couple ways that do it that work. I was going to just point out a couple that don't.
Yeah.
And maybe we can go back and forth on these two, but, because I want to give people just some takeaway tips and practical advice. Here's a don't. Let me just give you guys that. The silent partner, okay? If you're raising money and you're wanting to put someone into your partnership, do in your LLC operating agreement generally, or maybe you're doing an S-Corp and you've got a shareholder in there, you know, whatever you're doing. We'd usually do an LLC, but do not throw them in and put in words like they have no voting rights, they're a silent partner, don't do those things. That means they're not material. They cannot participate in the business with you. You're losing some of these ways we're trying to avoid you being in the crosshairs on securities laws. So avoid the silent partner. All right, John, you got a do or don't?
Yeah, I would. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I would just throw in there one silent partner, truly silent partner, is one too many. It's not, you know, that That's not an excuse. Well, it was just one person. Well, if they really never did anything and they just gave you money and walked away and said, I hope you turn us a profit, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, if you want the silent partner, go do the Reg D filing, you know, pay the fees, do all the legal paperwork, get the exemption, you know, with the SEC on your offering, comply with all those rules, and then you can have the silent partner.
Yep.
All right. Any other do's or don'ts you want to point out to people here?
I would say one thing to think about is how much do you need? What is it going to take to make this successful? Because that's where people will run into, I've seen it, where people will run into problems is I really need $500,000 to make this work.
Yeah.
But I get $200,000 or $300,000 and I try to make it work. Mm-hmm. You got to know, look, if I only get $200,000 or $300,000 here, maybe it's a no-go when I really needed $500,000 or, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You've got to be really, because that's when you start to get people upset with you. That's when people start to report this to state securities regulators, to the SEC. Yeah. So be really careful about taking, just going, well, I'll take whatever I can get. There needs to be a floor. And there also needs to be a ceiling. Don't take too much. You know, I don't know how to invest all this, or I don't need that much. And then you start using money maybe wastefully in a way that can get you into trouble. So have a floor and have a ceiling of what you want to raise.
Yeah. Okay. Let me give a do here. Do keep meticulous accounting records of how you're spending people's money. If someone puts money into your business, I don't care how you raise the money. And you end up, the business ends up failing for whatever reason, legitimate, illegitimate, whatever. It just doesn't work. You know, and there's risk in business. This happens. Let's be honest. Okay. I don't care how you raise the money. If you did it legally, you still are subjected. You could be subjected to a fraud claim, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody lost money. They're super upset. They were hoping on this money. You got them all excited probably before they put the money in. And so now they later go down the road and it's not there anymore. And they're told that I don't have anything to pay you back. Sorry. Well, that is a lot tough pill for some people to swallow. So many lawyers may sue you and say, well, even if you did it wrong, even if you raised the money right, you committed fraud in how you ran the business and you didn't treat the money how you said you were going to. And if your bank accounts for the company and your accounting records are a mess and you can't show that the business really did just fail, you've got some problems. And if people see like personal bank accounts and money going back and forth with your personal bank account from the business account you raised the money in, or maybe you didn't even have a business account and you screwed it up even from there, you're not going to look good in court on a fraud claim. Let me just say, if I was your attorney, I'd be like preparing you for disaster. You're definitely in triage there. So keep good records, treat other people's money respectfully, be meticulous about it. And think at any time, if one investor wanted to come in and see what was going on, that you could be very transparent about your books, that it all makes sense to them and they wouldn't have to worry about, you know, what you were doing with their money. So do keep good records no matter how you've raised their money.
Yeah. If you're sitting back there going, gosh, I don't know what I would do if investor X wanted to see the books of the company. Yeah, that's bad. That's a bad place for you to be.
Yeah, very true. All right. Any other do's or don'ts, takeaways, any other strategies you want to leave on the friends and family round of raising money?
Just to dovetail quickly on what you just said. If you're going down the partnership route and hey, these people do, and you said this, but I want to put a point on it. They do participate in the business. They are making decisions. They are helping. They are involved. Keep really meticulous records of that too. We had a vote on this. Here it was in writing. We had a meeting on this day and everybody signs off. Yep, this is what the meeting was about and this is what was decided. The more of that participation that you can show, material participation in the business, the less likely it is that this is going to be found to be a security later.
Yeah. Very true. I mean, those things, I know that when, you know, running a business, like, you know, doing the accounting and bookkeeping and keeping the good corporate records and notes of meetings, I know it doesn't sound fun. You just want the it's kind of like the cool car, you know, you got the cool car, you're the business owner now, but you don't want to do the maintenance on it. And eventually that thing's going to break down and it's going to be a piece of crap. It's not going to be a cool car anymore. So you got to do the little maintenance stuff that sucks. You got to change the oil, rotate the tires, so to speak. And that's the accounting, the bookkeeping, being diligent about keeping the money separate, keeping minutes and records of things that are going on in the business. Cause that's meant to protect you and the business in the long haul. And whether things go great or go bad, that stuff is going to be very valuable to you as a business owner. So,
absolutely.
Okay. Well, I just want to leave one comment on this is just on getting, taking off my lawyer hat. Well, I don't know, keeping the lawyer hat on is be careful raising money from friends and family because they are friends and family and business is risky. And do you want to feel awkward at the Thanksgiving dinner if your business doesn't work out for the rest of your life? Like maybe this is your mother-in-law or father-in-law's money you've taken, for example. Is your business and what you're doing are, I mean, you know your family. I'm just wanted to point this out. I've just ran across clients across the years who have partnered with family and they don't treat each other like family anymore. If that person's going to be at this family function, I'm not going and all this type of stuff. So, just be careful on that. Recognize that before you go in and take someone's money that's friends and family, because there is that personal relationship, and you know you may not want to risk that. I just wanted to kind of leave that on a personal note there.
Yeah, that just real quick. I always tell people strange things happen at the intersection of family and money, both in the raising money context, and I always say that in an estate planning context too. But it just does.
Very true. The relationships are definitely tested in those scenarios. So, well, thanks so much for being with us, Jerem. Thanks for joining me and giving your expertise here on raising money from friends and family. Check out the blog article Jerem wrote at kkoslawyers.com on the blog. Of course, reach out to Jerem. He knows much more about this than Mark and I do. It's helped a lot more clients than we have in raising money. Very valuable resource in this field. So, and he's got a book coming out too. I don't know. You want to start teasing that yet? I mean, he's putting together the framework of his book on raising money.
It's in the pipeline. Absolutely. I'm not giving anybody a date yet, but it's in the pipeline.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. Of course, we'll be back next week with another amazing episode of Refresh Your Wealth. And you can always go to the refreshyourwealth.com website to learn about upcoming shows, sign up for our free weekly newsletter, and to learn more about us. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's eBooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.